This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in, where we spend the hour on a few different topics. Today, we'll hear about some of the things several of our affiliate reporters are working on, including how cultural sensitivity is important in the fight against COVID-19. If vulnerable populations fear getting tested for one reason or another, it's harder to control the spread. Lauren Bavis from SideFX joins us in about 15 minutes on that. And reopening in a pandemic makes for an uncharacteristically quiet elementary school. Eric Weddle from WFYI stops by to talk about that. And later, Brock Turner from WFIU talks about the pandemic's threat to rural healthcare groups. Many are spending more on COVID-related expenses than they're taking in. And since fewer people are going in for routine visits, community healthcare groups aren't making nearly as much as usual. But first, we begin the way we always do on Fridays with a look at the big headlines from the past week with our digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Lauren, welcome.
Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Not too bad. The numbers is where we usually start. What did they look like this week?
Yeah, so as of noon today, 3,127 people have confirmed died from COVID-19. There are nearly 98,000 confirmed cases and nearly 1.5 million individual Hoosiers have been tested. So to compare that to last week, 3,058 people had died, more than 91,000 confirmed cases, and more than a million Hoosiers had been tested. So we've seen about an increase of 7,000 new cases this week, which happens to be about the same that we saw last week as well. Today, the state reported 1,044 new cases. That's the first time this week. The first time this week that we've had an increase of more than 1,000. And the color-coded map that we talked about last week, the state announced, was made live. So if you go to coronavirus.in.gov, you can see that map, which provides a really excellent kind of point-in-time look as to where your county is with new cases and what the landscape looks like overall.
This looks like a really, really effective and easy to understand map. When you look at it, I mean, can you kind of give us a snapshot of what each thing means? I'm looking at yellow counties and orange counties and blue counties. What does it all mean?
Yeah. So basically, they're distilling the information. It's a weekly score. 0 through 3. And that weekly score is based off of cases per 10,000 residents and a 7-day all tests positivity rate, which does include duplicate tests for folks who test positive, they retest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is a way of kind of navigating where everybody's at. So right now there's only one county that is considered red, which there is community spread happening right now. And that's actually Du Bois County. A lot of the orange counties happen to be rural counties right now, which is the next highest indicator of, you know, new cases and 7-day positivity rates. And then from there, yellow, where it's the community spread is fairly limited, and blue, where there is not an indication of community spread, but instead individual situations.
It looks from where I sit, and I could be looking at older information, it looks like Martin County is red and Du Bois County is orange. But either way, there are a few counties down there in southern Indiana that are looking, I guess, questionable as to on the positivity. But there are still plenty of blue counties, meaning a positivity rate at less than 5%, which seems to be the threshold that everyone keeps talking about.
Yeah, that's the CDC standard. I believe that's also the World Health Organization standard for, you know, this is a safe time to, you know, be out and about in the world. What's interesting about that is, especially with the blue counties a little bit northwest of Indianapolis, I'm thinking White, I'm thinking Cass County, Tippecanoe, that kind of area. These are counties that had previous spikes and have gone back down because of, you know, using masks, because of social distancing, because of measures that county governments have taken. So that's that's what makes this so important, or this kind of data so important. If you look at an overall cumulative map, Cass County has the highest cases per 100,000 residents or cases per 10,000 residents. But this is very much a point in time, weekly sort of way to navigate all of that data.
And Lauren, part of your job with Indiana Public Broadcasting is to sort of make things that look like this, ways to make this sort of information a little more readable and make a little more sense and to give it context. How would you critique what the state has done in creating this new map?
I gush about it, mostly because this is a way for, you know, it is important to understand the cumulative data, right? Like, that's important to understand where everything was or how it started. But this is also so insanely important for people who are making individual decisions, right? So, like, if I have something that I need to do in DeKalb County, I might be more diligent with wearing a mask, you know, avoiding, you know, doing things more in public. So it's giving people resources in order to make individual decisions.
Well, it looks great. And again, you can look at that yourself at coronavirus.in.gov. Okay, moving on, let's talk about this federal eviction moratorium that came down from the CDC.
Yeah, so Indiana is currently evaluating how that will affect Hoosiers. It was a moratorium issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the moratorium is effective until the end of December. So there are several criteria folks have to meet in order to qualify. First and foremost, people have to at least apply for as much governmental assistance as possible. The moratorium only applies to people who make less than $99,000 a year or $198,000 for those filing jointly. And people have to affirm under penalty of perjury that they can't make a full rent payment because of their loss of income. The moratorium also only applies if people are doing their best to at least make partial rent payments. And finally, if people can still get evicted unless they have nowhere else to go besides something like a homeless shelter.
And we did part of our show yesterday on this. And if you'd like to go back and listen to that podcast, you can do so wherever you get podcasts. We talked at the end of yesterday's show to someone from Indiana Legal Services, who we've had on the show before quite a few times, who had a lot of great information on how to navigate that. So you can go back in the podcast feed and check that out. What are housing advocates saying about this?
Yeah, they're saying that the new federal eviction moratorium is an opportunity for the state to address larger housing instability, a larger housing instability crisis. Prosperity Indiana Policy Director Andrew Bradley said the moratorium has the potential to help 300,000 Hoosier households, but individual courts will likely be the ones making decisions as to whether or not people qualify. Bradley said that such a response should include instead a task force that brings together landlords, tenants, and experts in public health and housing. And he also suggested that the state should reopen its rental assistance program, which closed last week. A state budget official hinted this week that more money could be added to renew that program. It's also important to note that there is a greater context that, you know, Indiana does have an eviction problem and has historically had an eviction problem. So this is just kind of amplifying that issue.
And one of the points that was brought up yesterday is that several of these renters who need to take advantage of this sort of thing they aren't even aware of some of these programs whenever they come up. And so getting the word out seems to be among the challenges that this is bringing toward us. Okay. Samantha Horton, our business reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, has been doing some great reporting on the impact of small businesses. What do we know?
Yeah, one in five small businesses in Indiana will have to permanently close by November without another round of federal loans, according to a small business advocacy group. The National Federation of Independent Businesses estimates more than 80% of small businesses that received a paycheck protection loan have used all of the money already in the most recent survey taken. The PPP program was designed to keep businesses from permanently shutting their doors due to COVID-19 by issuing forgivable loans to help employees on payroll and pay rent. The NFB state director, Barbara Quant, says small businesses need another round of PPP loans to continue to survive the economic impacts of the pandemic. And she said the organization is advocating for other measures, including businesses being protected from COVID-19 liability lawsuits and regulatory protections.
So if 20% of small businesses fail in Indiana due to the pandemic, that could be very bad. And hopefully in Washington, something ends up being done about that. The State Board of Education, there's some news about, what is it, federal funding for schools that reopen virtual only? They want to protect that.
Yeah, so it's actually state funding.
State funding, okay.
Yeah, so way back 3 whole weeks ago, which I panicked today and thought was only last week, Governor Eric Holcomb offered this solution where we were going to push back the fall student count date. And instead, the Indiana State Board of Education unanimously approved a proposal to maintain full funding levels for schools operating online this fall. School leaders and educators say it offers some much needed stability. So the change means that schools will receive 100% of funding for students learning remotely because of COVID-19. If a school and its students were virtual full time before stay-at-home orders, the pandemic, you know, the everything, they will receive they will only receive that 85% of funding per state law. But the action temporarily works around rules meant to dissuade schools from offering virtual instruction full time. Now, this solution is very different than the solution Governor Eric Holcomb offered. And in fact, a memo to the school board said the fall student count day will happen as planned in mid-September. It says rather than delay, the state can use data from the last time students were counted to determine whether or not they should receive virtual level funding. Jeannie's done an insanely good job talking with school leaders and kind of getting the boots on the ground sort of understanding of what this kind of impact has. And so it's making things a lot easier to kind of understand what's going on.
Big thanks to Jeannie and a big thanks to you. Lauren Chapman sits at the laptop all day and loves it. At least we're pretty sure. She's our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Lauren, do me a favor and have a good long weekend.
You as well, Matt.
Up next, what is there to be afraid of when it comes to COVID testing? Aside from how uncomfortable it is, what if you don't trust the healthcare industry or if you fear being put on a list? Lauren Bavis from Side Effects Public Media breaks it down for us in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Testing is crucial to slowing the spread of COVID-19, but testing only really works if it serves all demographics. And some sites in Indiana have fallen short on the sort of cultural sensitivity that establishes trust with the community. Side Effects Public Media's Lauren Bavis has been looking into this, and she joins us now. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt.
So one of the sparks for this story took place in Goshen, Indiana. What happened?
So for my story, I got to speak with Liliana Quintero, and she's the director of the Northern Indiana Hispanic Health Coalition. And so her organization has provided interpreters to many of the testing sites in Northern Indiana, including in Goshen. And so Liliana told me one of the interpreters called her in late June at this Goshen site and told her that the nurse in charge planned to call the police when she saw any Hispanic people coming in to get tested. And that was a huge problem because around this time in late June and early July, COVID cases were really increasing in Elkhart in Northern Indiana. So the local and state health departments were called in and they closed the site. The site was run by OptumServe, this company the state contracted to provide COVID testing in all sorts of places. And they replaced it pretty quickly with a site that's run by the state.
Was the nurse fired? Was that taken care of?
Yeah, Optum, in a statement, they said that they severed their relationship with the nurse.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is obviously a problem. There shouldn't be racial profiling, but how much can this affect testing among Latinx communities?
Right. And for this story, I spoke with other community health workers around the state who work with Latinx Hoosiers and specifically undocumented immigrants. And they said that stories spread over social media like WhatsApp, like wildfire when they hear what happens in a community like Goshen. And it makes Latinx and undocumented folks think, you know, if this could happen in Goshen, it could happen anywhere. And the result is that people in Goshen might not go in for testing and undocumented people across the state might be less likely to go in for testing anywhere.
So why is it important for those communities to be tested, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, across the country, and Indiana is really no exception, Latinx and other people of color have been disproportionately impacted and affected by COVID-19. In Indiana, Hispanic people are about 7% of the state's population, but they account for 10% of cases and 2% of deaths. And this is a group that is more vulnerable to health problems in the best of times. Research shows Hispanic folks are less likely to be insured. They're less likely to have a regular doctor and use healthcare regularly, which means they're, you know, less likely to be diagnosed with a chronic illness if they have one. And those chronic illnesses have been shown to be a huge contributor of having more severe COVID complications. And a lot of them work in jobs that put them at higher risk for COVID, places where they work in close quarters, or they can't get time off if they show symptoms.
Does this problem go beyond the Latinx population into other racial or ethnic groups?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what I just described is also true for Black Hoosiers. They account of 11% of cases and 14% of deaths, despite being only 10% of Indiana's population.
And is it for a lot of the same reasons, that this lack of trust?
It is lack of trust. It's a lot of these chronic health conditions that, you know, are because of years of problems that sometimes don't even have to do with healthcare yet, like you said, mistrust and living in areas that don't have good access to healthcare, things like that.
So some of these problems seem to have to do with a disconnect between health officials at the state level and they're at the local level. What does that look like?
Yeah, I think disconnect is a really good word. And I mean, a huge example of that is the state said that people who work at testing sites don't ask about immigration or citizenship status. They said that right now their priority is getting people tested and reducing the spread of COVID. But that disconnect comes into play where some of the health workers I spoke to said that hasn't been a clear and consistent top-down message. And so then they don't feel comfortable telling the people they work with that if they go to a testing site, they'll be safe from immigration backlash. And so then that could lead to people who really need to get tested not getting those tests.
And there are some other things at play, too. There have been, I guess, in your reporting, you talked about some of the sites taking pictures of IDs just to make sure that spelling is correct on the names and things like that. And that can raise some red flags among these populations, right?
Right. I mean, if you don't have an ID or a driver's license, or there, you know, was a huge issue where a lot of the consulates that provide immigration services and visas and things like that had to shut down or suspend parts of their service for a while. And so documents are out of date. And so they worry, you know, what they show might not be accepted. The state said that they don't ask for ID necessarily, but then the stories I heard from the local workers is that they wanted some kind of proof of address, if that was an ID or a piece of mail. And the taking pictures of it, yeah, would be really concerning. You know, why is that something that they're keeping a record of? And so the folks who I spoke to said that they've had to go back to their local and state health departments and say, you know, here's what we're experiencing on the ground and that our clients are saying and why we need to adjust our expectations and our behavior.
Did the groups you talked to offer any kind of solution or treatment to these issues?
They did. And I think they were really appreciative of the state's efforts over the past few months. And they understand that its task to control this new and deadly virus is monumental. And they said that they wish that they had been brought to the table and brought to the table early as the state developed their response so they could say, you know, look, here's what we think we could do better to reach the people who we work with. And when that's happened, it's worked. There was another example in my story that happened in Fort Wayne, where the state said they wanted to test folks as part of a study to show how COVID was spreading across Indiana. And they reached out to community groups and said, hey, we should partner. They were doing, you know, what the community groups are saying are best practices. But there is this also history, a long history of researchers and government organizations coming into predominantly Black and Brown communities, doing their research projects and leaving and not giving back to the communities they spend time in. And so those community groups in Fort Wayne said, unless you want to give back, we can't help you. And the state agreed, and they opened this testing site in Fort Wayne that tested more than 300 people in one day. And these were, you know, Black residents and Latinx residents and undocumented folks. And they also have a significant Burmese refugee population. These are all people who've been disproportionately impacted by the virus. And so, I mean, their overall solution is that they hope that things that happened, like this incident in Goshen, don't happen again, but that they're eye-openers and that the state will call on this local expertise in the future as they continue to build their response.
I guess another way to understand why this is such a problem, we could look at a parallel here. We can look, I guess, more generally at health disparities among Black and Latinx communities in Indiana. What do we know about that?
Yeah, I've done previous reporting about another really stark health disparity in Indiana, and that's maternal and infant mortality. Black and Latinx moms and babies are much more likely to die in childbirth or in the first year after giving birth. And a lot of that has to do with really similar things that we discussed. Some of it's their treatment by doctors. Women say they aren't listened to when they say they're in pain or something doesn't feel right. And there's this history of mistrust because these are populations that have been experimented on in medical settings in the past. So they come into a hospital or a healthcare provider with a history of wariness. And then there's another broader issue that you might have heard about since the start of the pandemic and talking about equity issues, and that's the social determinants of health. That's things like where you live and your access to food and education and things like that, that maybe don't seem like they're related to health on the onset, but they have a huge impact on your health. And historically, those have led to worse health outcomes in Black and brown folks.
Great information. Lauren Bavis is a reporter for Side Effects Public Media, a health news collaborative based out of our flagship station, WFYI, in Indianapolis. Lauren, thanks.
Yeah, anytime.
And now a look at schools. WFYI education reporter Eric Weddle has been hard at work covering what reopening looks like. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Matt.
So you looked at Chapelwood Elementary in Wayne Township, which is a district with a good reputation in a lot of areas and one that you cover a lot. How are things different there right now?
Right. Well, so in Wayne Township Schools, it is a school district that you can choose to go in full-time in person, or you can choose to do full-time virtual. And I went to Chapelwood Elementary before school started just to kind of get a feeling for what the staff and the teachers were doing. And at that time, you know, they were just trying to figure out how is this going to work. So I went back there about a week after school started to see, and it's really quiet in the school building. You know, everyone's wearing masks, teachers are masked, students are all in masks, and there's a lot of distancing, a lot of spacing, and that just kind of changes the vibe at the school, and you could really feel it just walking around in the hallway, being in classrooms. It was very muted.
What are all these safety precautions doing to the learning environment?
You know, that was probably the biggest concern I've heard from educators, you know, before schools open. You know, how are they going to do this? You know, like I mentioned, the classroom looking traditional. A lot of, you know, teachers in elementary school, they want to get their kids together on the floor. And so the class I was in, the teacher was really trying to find a way to break out of this very formal setting that has been created. So she was doing this thing called Circle Up, which she said she learned from another teacher, where, you know, in the morning after they got started, she would get students to sit on top of their desks. You know, not a big change, but you don't sit on your desk normally in school, right? So this was kind of a way to kind of break up the morning, a way for them to answer questions, to get a little more active, interactive. And I think it was just a way to kind of make this feel fun, which sometimes I think right now is more difficult when everyone is trying to remember all these new rules and safety precautions.
What about virtual? Are some of the kids there at Chapelwood learning from home?
So if you at Chapelwood and all Wayne Township schools in this district, you can choose one or the other to be in class or at home. But at that school, they actually do have teachers who are teaching virtual. So they are set up in the gymnasium in kind of like these their own classrooms, and they are online live, and they are teaching students at home.
And you talked to the head custodian there at Chapelwood Elementary as well. I imagine they're busy. What are they doing differently?
Yeah, so when I was at the school, I ran into Kirsten Prissy, who is the head custodian, and I saw her doing a lot of work, briefly coming out of a bathroom with a bunch of trash bags. And I just spent some time with her, and I asked her, you know, what was different this year compared to last year? And this is what she told me.
Now we're cleaning every single chair, every single lunch, and we have to clean the whole chair instead of just where the parts that the kids are sitting in. And then in the classrooms, We usually would get the door handles, the light switches, and things like that, but it wouldn't be nearly as much as we're doing now. Now we are strictly focusing on all the high touch points. The fronts of hand sanitizers, the light switches, door handles, even the handles to the teacher's filing cabinets.
So it seems like it goes pretty far beyond the usual responsibilities of an elementary school custodian.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that they're trying to figure out. You know, she says they feel a lot of pressure just because they want to make this school as clean as possible. So, you know, the virus is not spread. You know, they kind of see themselves as this defense force. And yeah, there was a lot of things that they told me they were doing that I never would have thought of.
And so we're talking about Wayne Township, which is a district that's offering students the choice to attend either in person or from home virtually. But there is a lot of pressure from some to make schools exclusively in person, which is another thing that you're reporting on. Where is this pressure coming from?
Right. Well, I think, you know, for months now, we have seen President Donald Trump, you know, say schools should reopen. He's called for them all to reopen. He's recently really criticized virtual learning. Representative Jim Banks from the Indiana congressional delegation, he authored a bill that would try and, you know, take federal funding away from schools if they didn't fully open. So you've seen that coming down from way from the top, from the federal government. You know, some states have set different kind of guidelines for when schools should reopen, when they can offer in-person education. Here in Indiana, we really haven't had that kind of top-down approach. It's really been left to the local school districts, the elected school boards, and their local health departments to kind of work together and figure out what is best. And so that's kind of the decision that we're seeing. We have been the past 2 months that's been going on, and that we're seeing now as schools trying to figure out if they should reopen or not.
And indeed, this week, on Wednesday afternoon, in fact, the governor announced a new plan for school districts. What's in it?
Right. So local school boards have been the ones in power, you know, to decide what they want to do. But they also have been calling, you know, for the governor and the state to kind of just give them some kind of more guidance on when they should have students in school. The state teachers associations have called for that. So this week, the governor is putting out this map, the governor's office, the health department, that kind of shows what's going on in your county. It's going to be a color-coded map that's going to give different levels of the response that's recommended. It's not being forced. Schools don't have to follow it, but they're recommendations of how they should kind of tweak activities, gatherings, and in-person school. And so that's going to come out. And, you know, and it's probably going to help some school districts decide what they should or should not do. It's going to give them one more, you know, piece of information to look at that the community can look at together.
So there is a lot of autonomy. Do the school officials that you've spoken with seem to appreciate that?
You know, I had not spoken to anyone since, you know, in the hour since that was released fully. But I think school leaders have wanted more input. I think they were hoping that there would have been more information handed down from the governor's office on what they could do, because it's a huge decision to make. And they got a lot of different, you know, issues to deal with. You know, it's like the health and safety issues that school districts are dealing with right now are very new to them. And they are leaning very heavily on local health departments for guidance on this. So I'm sure everyone is going to be very happy that there's more information that they can now look at.
You listened in on a school board debate on reopening. What was that like?
Right. So Washington Township Schools was one of the first school districts in the state to decide to go fully virtual, only offer online courses when the school year started because of the pandemic. And last week, the school board had a meeting to kind of decide what metrics they were going to use to decide if they were going to come back. And so the school administration, they recommended that there would be a 5% infection rate be the trigger for when students could return in class to school. And so the infection rate is the percentage of people who test positive for COVID-19. And the district said, if that rate is 5% for 2 weeks, students can come back. Members of the school board were not happy with that. A few members said they thought that it should be a much higher rate, which would allow students to attend school sooner. You know, getting down to 5% for 2 weeks, you know, could take a long time based on what we're seeing in the community spread. And it was just, you know, interesting to see this debate between these elected officials and the school leaders, because some districts have been having these discussions in closed sessions where the public can't attend. And what you saw during this meeting was just this concern for how do you have the health and safety issue, and how do you weigh that with the academic piece? Because during this meeting also, there was discussion about how some of the challenges they're facing with the virtual-only learning, how some students aren't logging in, they're not sure if some students are actually like attending the online classes, some students just are not doing well social emotionally either, you know, in this virtual environment. So you want them back in person, but how do you make the decision of when that happens? And in the end, that 5% metric for the district was approved to begin a phase in of in-person learning. But, you know, you could tell it was very challenging for those school board officials to make that decision.
Are there other data points that schools could be looking at?
Right. So, you know, that the infection rate is one that kind of like is the main one. You know, I think everyone agrees that the infection rate is what local communities should understand to know how the virus is being transmitted in the community. I recently was on a webinar about school reopenings with some health experts and heard from Sarah Johnson, who's an associate professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins State University's School of Medicine. And she was saying there's also a lot of other data local schools can start looking at, like how many students and staff are sent home for COVID-19 symptoms, how many fail health screenings when they come to campus, and how many are absent. And she said, you know, being absent doesn't mean a student or teacher has COVID, but it can give some insight into how families and staff are treating a light fever. You know, are they staying home because they're trying to be as safe as possible? You know, they're trying to limit exposure, potential exposure. And that all that data, if once you get it, it could maybe help you figure out what your community is like going forward. Because as she put it, you know, this issue is not going to go away soon. And so schools want to get as much information that they can to know what's happening inside their building. And that big infection rate number may not really be an exact mirror of what's happening in their school community.
Eric Weddle reports on education for our flagship station WFYI in Indianapolis. Eric, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Up next, routine doctor visits are down in Indiana due to concerns about the pandemic. We'll hear from WFIU's rural affairs reporter in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Since the pandemic hit, many people are hesitant to go to the doctor for fear of catching the virus from someone who's sick. This means there's been a big drop in preventative care services. Brock Turner has been reporting on this from WFIU in Bloomington, and he's here with us now. Hi, Brock.
How's it going, Matt?
Not too bad. So far, fewer people are going to the doctor. It makes sense why, but, I mean, what does it mean for the primary care industry?
Well, Matt, it means less profit for healthcare systems, those doctors that are a part of it. So something to keep in mind is that with the healthcare industry, it really relies on preventative care and these so-called elective procedures that we talk about. Much of these were shut down at the beginning of the pandemic, and providers were expecting those patient numbers would return quickly, but that really hasn't happened.
So how many people are opting to not come in for routine visits? Is there a percentage?
It really depends on who you ask. One provider outside of Indianapolis told me that they have internal data showing that about 20% of people say they're just not going to return to those preventative care type of procedures until the pandemic's over, until we have some type of therapy or vaccine. It really depends, though, on the individual, and it really comes down to the individual. A lot of folks that I've talked with have said, yeah, they're really concerned about seeking out those services. And the big reason for that is because they feel like they're putting themselves at greater risk for going to the doctor as opposed to taking their chances with whatever, you know, potential illness that they could have that they're just not getting addressed.
What about rural hospitals? Have they been hit by this as well?
They really have been, and probably more so than other communities throughout the state. So rural hospitals, a couple things that I'll mention. Many of them are small and are of the critical access variety. So what we mean by when we say critical access, it's actually a government designation that gives them extra federal funds, but it limits the size and scope of the services that they can offer. So while a large hospital in Indianapolis attached to a research university or just a large private hospital might have a vast array of services and different specialty services, the critical access hospitals aren't going to have that. It's going to be more bare bones. They'll have an emergency department. I believe they're capped at around 15 beds. And And those facilities are going to really tailor their services to the populations that they serve. The reason that they've been hit hard is because populations that they serve tend to be sicker, older, but also those hospitals typically aren't connected to a large health system. So when we're talking about ordering PPE or securing, you know, additional bed capacity, even finding help in those communities and physical people, doctors and nurses and support staff, it's typically more of a challenge.
All that said, yeah, I mean, are any of these smaller hospitals at a significant financial risk, like maybe closures?
Yeah, so we've seen some closures and some word of closures before, and industry folks are really sounding alarms that we very well could see closures to these facilities if we don't do something to address it. The reason for that, as I mentioned, all of the pandemic, you know, extra stressors that have come on and challenges, but something that I would add to that is these hospitals really weren't terribly secure in their finances to begin with. They were running really lean before, and a lot of that has to do with the patient makeup. For traditional hospitals and health systems, a small portion of their patient base comes in through Medicaid, which is government health insurance. It reimburses healthcare systems at a lower rate than what private insurance companies do. So the greater share of those patients that a hospital has or a health system has, the less money per service that they're getting. So, for example, if person A is on private insurance and person B is on Medicare or Medicaid, person B's procedure will be reimbursed at a lower rate for those services. So that's a big piece of this and figuring out that right funding formula.
There's another interesting point in your reporting, and it's something that we actually touched on earlier this hour with Lauren Bavis from Side Effects Public Media, the fact that people of color have been hit hard by COVID and they're also less likely to seek preventative care. Are there parallels between those populations and the rural populations you've reported on?
Yeah, Matt, there definitely are parallels. We see a lot of commonalities, and most of them really come back to these systemic issues and injustices, frankly, that are built into our healthcare system right now. I would say the two biggest issues are, one is transportation. That looks very different for folks that are in a urban area versus those that are in a rural community. But the root cause is really the same. Practitioners are not really accessible to the areas that they are serving in a lot of cases. So lack of transportation or insurance can really be significant. The second one that I mentioned is insurance, which we kind of touched on earlier, where folks that are on those government plans, or maybe they even don't have insurance, it really creates a challenge. And maybe even someone who has insurance but doesn't have the funds, which with so many people out of work during this pandemic, that's only exacerbated the concerns. So it's really a litany of issues, and all of which are really difficult to solve, and there's not really a direct, easy answer to solve this.
Would you say that these are new problems?
No, I definitely don't think these are new issues. The pandemic has sort of taken, and COVID has sort of taken a magnifying glass and highlighted these problems. But a lot of the reasons that you see, especially people of color, dying at a higher rate, frankly, from COVID-19, is that these issues are built into our systems. And until we can really find a way to systemically change healthcare, we're going to continue to find these inequities, and people are going to continue to struggle staying healthy in communities that are underserved.
Brock Turner reports on rural affairs for our affiliate WFIU in Bloomington. Brock, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
And now for some bittersweet news. When our show started last summer, the first person we hired to be on the team was our assistant producer, Maggie Galon. Since then, she's produced at least one show a week. If you've heard us on a Tuesday, chances are you've heard the results of her hard work on the air. Today is her last day, and she joins us now. Maggie, I've been waiting and waiting to get you on the air, and I guess this is as good a time as any.
Matt Pelser, it's great to be here.
So this was like your first job in journalism, and I'm not going to say how young you are, but you're young. You're much younger than I am. And you just hit the ground running. What did you do before you came to this job?
I was teaching. So I graduated in 2018 from Indiana University, and I studied journalism. I studied political science, but I actually spent that first year after graduation abroad, and I was teaching in Thailand. So it was a really incredible opportunity, experience. And yeah, I'm always going to have a little bit of a teacher's heart in me, and education has just been something I really hold near and dear.
So where are you headed?
I'm headed to Nashville. Yeehaw. I'm so excited. In a crazy whirlwind turn of events, I'm headed to Nashville. I'm going to be doing marketing for a firm down there, and I'm excited for a new chapter.
I'm excited for you. So like I said earlier, this was your first kind of big journalism job, and you really did well right out the gate. I mean, what was it about the process of putting this show together, I don't know, that you really kind of found challenging initially?
Well, great question. The process is quite similar to if you were to write a story in print, just in that you are, you know, coming up with those key questions that you want to answer for your audience. You're gathering sources that they're going to want to hear from. The part that is challenging is that, you know, in the before times when we were having folks come into the studio to do the show, for me, it was really challenging to wrap my head around the fact that they were going to show up, that people were going to take time out of their busy day to come sit in the studio with us, have a face-to-face conversation. And I just remember those first several episodes, just being giddy after every episode and smiling and looking at whoever was in the studio with me and saying, they came, they showed up, they wanted to talk to us. That's a lot different, you know, to ask people to come to you again and again. And people in the Indianapolis community and beyond were just so generous with their time and never let us down.
Yeah. And well, and that's changed an awful lot in COVID land. I mean, how has your job changed now that you're working from home?
Yeah, you got it. I mean, we are producing a daily statewide talk show from our homes. Matt, you are in your basement. You are hosting a statewide show from your basement. And yeah. I know you've got your dog next to you most days.
Yeah, he's right here.
Barley. I mean, that is wild when you think about it, that we're able to do what we do. I mean, I'm sitting in my 500 square foot apartment next to my little window, staring out the Monon Trail, watching people walk by me every day. And meanwhile, I've been fostering throughout this COVID time. I've got a horde of little baby kittens crawling over me. You know, meanwhile, I'm trying to get a hold of the Secretary of State's office. It's wild when you think about it. And I'm just so thankful that we've been able to do what we do.
And the show won a couple of awards. We found out about that in June. One of them was an award from the Public Media Journalists Association an award for audience engagement. And this was a show that we did last year that we could not have done now because times have really, really changed. It was a show essentially on a problem caused by very low unemployment. There was a talent shortage. And I'm guessing that we got so much engagement on that show because so many, you know, professionals were at home listening. And we do have a large audience of professionals. And so many of them, and at the time we couldn't take voicemails yet, so many of them were engaging with us on social media. And that was a show that you produced. When that happened, and it was just, I mean, we were off of our prep for most of that show because right out of the gate, people were emailing and Facebooking. And I don't know, when that happened and it all started to kind of come together and sort of break down in a very beautiful and productive way, how did you feel about that?
I mean, that's what's so special about this show in particular is that we are a talk show, but we are a talk show where Hoosiers, our audience, they are part of that conversation in a way that is so real and in the moment. We can ask questions that we're getting from our audience in real time. So it was just really exciting to watch that avalanche of comments and questions come in, because it's also confirmation for us that folks are listening. So that's huge to know. You know, we produce these shows in our own little bubble, but when we get that kind of engagement and feedback, again, it's a reminder that people are listening, that people are engaged in the topics. But that's helping people. It is something that is useful to people. So it's so, so exciting. And we have the unique opportunity to be a direct link between our audience and the people that are oftentimes the direct source of information. So for instance, when we've been in, you know, COVID times, we've had multiple times on the show, Shandy Dirth and Tom Dzinski, I want to give them a shout out, amazing epidemiologists from the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. So we're talking about, you know, top-notch epidemiologists that will come on the show. And if you're at home trying to sift through information about COVID and you want to know what is factual, what you need to know in real time, you can call in and you can ask Tom Dzinski and Shandy Dirth directly a question about COVID, and they'll answer that. Like, that is incredible. And all I can think is, you know, I've had to wait 3+ months for a dermatology appointment in my lifetime. So the fact that you can just call and they will answer a question, it's just a really unique opportunity that I'm so glad we're able to offer our audience. And I hope people keep taking advantage of that, because we want to be able to answer those questions.
And I mean, we've got, have you been surprised at all at the number of resources just within our organization, Indiana Public Broadcasting, and also our many affiliates, the kind of help that we've gotten? I think every time I reach out to a reporter and they're always down to help us out, I look at that as a big blessing. Do you?
Oh, so we're a small team. The team that actually puts together the daily talk show, it's 2.5 people. It's a really small team. And what makes it achievable is our bigger, broader team. I mean, we work really closely with all the incredible reporters that are part of the IPB team, but also affiliates throughout the state. I mean, just today, we're hearing from Lauren Bavis, who's part of Side Effects, Eric Weddle from WFYI, Brock Turner from WFIU. We just have this huge network of top-notch, dedicated reporters throughout the state that are able to tell us these local stories that we just wouldn't hear otherwise without their amazing work. So not only are they reporting these stories, but they're more than happy to take the time to then share them, explain the context to you, me, our other producer, Drew. They've really gone above and beyond and made this show possible.
What was your favorite show in the last year?
Oh, my goodness. I've loved so many of our shows. There's been so many bright moments. But for me, a personal favorite was a show that we did this past May, May 19th, if people want to go back and listen to it. We interviewed Glenn Gass. So he was a retiring
Dr. Rock.
You got it. He was a professor at Indiana University who had, you know, pioneered a program that taught the history of rock and roll. And this was really special to me because I went to IU. I not only took these classes, but I snuck into a lot of these classes when I had free time, because he was incredible. He was a gem of a professor, and his classes were electric. People loved going to these. So because he was retiring, we thought, hey, we'll showcase his career. And, you know, before we do shows, we get the opportunity to pre-interview the guests on the show. And I was shaken, like, before I did this pre-interview with him, because to me, he is a rock star. And throughout the process, I'm learning that he taught over 60,000 students at Indiana University. So it was not just me. There are a lot of Hoosiers that interacted with him and felt that same magic. And then sure enough, the day of the show, before it even aired, we were getting voicemails and comments from people on social media, just sharing how much they also enjoyed him and loved him. And he's a Hoosier legend. And again, it just highlights, you know, the national news might not cover his retirement, but he was so special to so many people. And the fact that we got to showcase that meant a lot to me. And I'm so glad that other people enjoyed it as well.
Well, Maggie, you know this, or at least I hope you know this, on behalf of the whole team, our tiny little team that cranks out this show every single day, we're really going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you guys too. I am. I just want to say it's been an honor and a privilege to work on this show, and I'm so thankful I got to be a part of it in these beginning days.
I'm sad that this is the last time I'll say it this way. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. We are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening and have a great Labor Day weekend. This is All In.